Welcome to Tuesday morning and this new course called Don't Get Hooked. Okay, so this begins, we normally do, we take refuge together and we generate a mind of enlightenment. We'll consider the four boundless thoughts as the precursor to the mind of enlightenment. We'll say a mantra together for a little bit and we'll actually engage in the class. So just a couple of slides here, like I said, refuge in bodhicitta. The four boundless thoughts, and we'll say a mantra together, then begin. So please just get comfortable in your seat. You want to have your back straight and your shoulders relaxed. Just check that your head is sort of sitting evenly on your neck. And then sort of drop your eyes so that they're either completely closed or they're partially closed. And you have a little bit of light coming in. And when you are sitting comfortably and at ease, you'll just let the body breathe itself. And relaxing into awareness. Imagine the ground beneath you is very, very soft, made of starry sapphire light. And the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. Directly in front of you, at the level of your eyebrows, in space, is a throne. And on that throne is a lotus. On top of the lotus is a sun disc lying flat, and on top of that, a moon disc lying flat. And sitting on the moon disc is the Buddha Shakyamuni. Golden in color. He's wearing the three robes of the monk. His left hand is holding a begging bowl. His right arm and hand reach down to touch the earth. And he is surrounded by an assembly of enlightened beings. These include bodhisattvas, deities, and other beings like the protectors. Meanwhile, we are sitting on the ground. It's very soft, or up on our seat, it's very soft. And we're surrounded by all sentient beings. And these include our parents, family, relatives, strangers, and difficult people. And we take the time now to appreciate that we are still alive. And while we are alive, we have the leisure and opportunity to attain the spiritual goal that we've set for ourselves. We will need to act quickly, though, because everything is in a constant state of flux and change. We have met a spiritual friend, and they are leading us in the safe direction of these three rare sublimates. Finding confidence in the Buddha, his teachings, and his community, we have decided to bring all sentient beings along with us to that same three objects of refuge. So to make the offering of practice as purely as possible, recollect emptiness. Imagine the wisdom that realizes this emptiness takes the form of a clear deity. You're saying, this is me, this is who I actually am. In one hand you hold the vajra and in the other the bell. This symbolizes emptiness and bodhicitta. I think that you're sitting within a sphere of great enjoyment. So you feel good. You feel good because you have it within you to lead all these beings who surround you in the safe direction of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And so you say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response, this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve into yourself and all living beings in the negative karma and obstructions collected over countless lifetimes are purified. And your good health and lifespan, your virtues, your understandings and realizations, these are all increased. The thing that your body, speech and mind have been cleansed by the wisdom realizing emptiness. They've also been fortified with compassionate love. And so you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And you decide to develop each yourself and help everybody else do the same. And to affirm that, you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And again, these dissolve into yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. And all of our obstructions and negative karmas are purified. Our good health and our lifespan are increased, along with our virtues and realizations and understandings. So next time you inhale, exhale and completely just relax. Just let the air go and relax completely. From within this relaxed state of awareness, imagine that you can hear the mantra of the Buddha. And the sounds of this mantra reveal a complete path to enlightenment. And hearing the mantra, we recite it, let's say, three times, and then under your breath silently a number of other times. So please join me in saying, Tayata Muni Muni Mahamanasaha. Tayata Muni Muni Mahamanasaha. Tayata Muni Muni Mahamanasaha. I think that depends upon hearing the sound of the mantra. You've brought all beings to enlightenment. You've accomplished your own aims and are able to fulfill the aims of others. Now, I think this is your wish. Your wish is to develop your wisdom and your compassion and all your skills fully, so you're able to effortlessly and spontaneously help others free themselves from suffering and its causes and develop all good qualities. And now breathing in through nostrils, exhale through your mouth, and let your eyes flutter up and bring your awareness back to the room. So again, welcome. And we're starting a new course today. It's about what we call the eight worldly concerns. And so today we're going to sort of introduce what these eight are. And you'll see here they are concerns that deal with our way of being in the world, ourselves as people, and our feelings. But also how and what we're concerned with in terms of our reputation and in society itself. So today we're primarily going to focus on just introducing these eight worldly concerns. They're made up of four pairs, so you'll know what they are by the end of this morning. In our second class, we start looking at them and to know what can we do about them. So next week, we'll look at the physical and felt concerns, and the week after, the social and reputational concerns. So although there's not a lot of material that you can find online about this, I mean, if you plug it into a Google search or something, that is helpful. It'll take you off to different places and commentaries. But there's one of the things that they say in the text, they talk about equalizing these worldly concerns. But there's no information about how you do that. So that's a little tricky. Anyway, this book here, Science and Philosophy, there's quite a useful commentary there by the Dalai Lama on what it means to equalize, what this word means and how you can do it. The book next to it, How to Practice Dharma, Teachings on the Eight Worldly Dharmas by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, is probably the best you'll read here. Really in depth, but at the same time readable and easily understandable, and an explanation of terms that I've never come across before, like the word worldly, for instance, and even the word dharma. It's a different meaning here than what we normally understand it to be. Teachings from Tibet down the bottom there, there's another little commentary on that really concerns by the Dalai Lama. And of course, Foundation of Buddhist Practice, another commentary. So I try to get these ones with this holding this through it, because often they get a little bit more depth into it. Plus, it's very readable to them. Yes, I've used these primary books here. But what we'll be doing today is we're going to be looking at what we call the reactivity, like what generates these worldly concerns. And it's basically a reactive state of mind. We'll talk about that. And then we come to these four pairs. And finally, what we might be able to do about that. And like I said, we cover that in more depth next week and then we come to it. Okay, so let's begin by looking at this section on reactivity. So we talk about these eight worldly concerns. They are effects that produce more behaviors. So an effect has to have a cause. Right? So the causes of these eight worldly concerns, they're basically rooted in clinging. And the clinging has these two aspects. So one is called self-grasping ignorance. This is the root of all of our problems. Right? So there's that. But along with it comes its sort of best mate, self-cherishing. So often they compare them to the Prime Minister and the Treasurer. You know, they have the control over the country. Well, these two take control over us. And from that, those like the Prime Minister and the Treasurer, they make all these decisions, don't they? And the country follows. Well, these two, self-grasping and self-clinging, they make decisions. And we go along. And then we get in trouble. So it's useful to sort of identify these two problem makers. So, okay, that's the different route. there's a real good reason for that, because the basic reason is most of us see our problems being like out there. These guys say, no, the problems are actually in here, these two guys, you know, clinging and self-cherishing, self-grasping, self-cherishing. You know, as we say, gee, the country's going to pop, you know, like it's ruined. And we look for someone to blame, don't we? It often goes to like a political party or who is running the country at the moment. And you'll find us often, you know, probably put our focus on the prime minister and those treasuries and that, and we complain about them. Buddhism says that's right, the real source of our problem is self-grasping and self-cherishing. So when we come to blame anything for our problems, it should be one of those two. Because they're the major, yeah, they're the major troublemakers. When they make decisions, we have to go along. And so we need to identify them, basically. So we have this word clinging, and it's two roots. So clinging here means desirous attachment. Yeah, so, and what you go, okay, so it's got these two roots. What are the drivers of this desirous attachment? You know, self-grasping and self-cherishing. And depends upon them, we have this desirous attachment or aversion. So it's the root of this clinging is self-cherishing. And self-cherishing is a deluded mental factor that regards one's own welfare as supremely important. So it's just another way of saying, when we think about things, but it's going to be you or me, we always go me, like I'm more important. And that's coming out of this, when we say it, we're saying it because we have a wrong understanding of who we are. That's the self-grasping. So self-grasping presents a wrong, identifies us wrongly, and then self-cherishing just goes along with it, says, I need to look after you. And the way I need to look after you is to push away anything that we call a problem and grab as much as we can to make you feel good. So the clinging observes the contaminated objects like gain or praise, exaggerates their attractiveness, and then insists upon procuring. And this self-cherishing arises from the deeper ignorance of self-grasping. So I just want to get across to you this idea. We've got the root, this is self-grasping and self-cherishing. These two go along. They produce this clinging, also called desirous attachment. What's it towards? All the things we like. So it's gain, praise, pleasure, good reputation. Whatever we think is good, self-cherishing is interested in that. It's good for us. What have I written here? So here they are. These are the two roots, self-cherishing, self-grasping. That's a major thing to take away from this. This is underneath everything else that's going to follow. So this clinging is like the internal force within us. It drives the pursuit of these four desirable factors, gain, fame, praise, and pleasure. And this, in its pursuit of gain and fame, praise and pleasure, we get a lot of emotional reactivity. And this emotional reactivity is the chief obstacle preventing the mind from just being stable and at ease. Because we want stuff, you know, we want things. I don't want to pull them in or push them away. So the mind can't just relax, like it's busy. And so this clinging is really just like the root of our dissatisfaction, and it does prevent liberation. And the idea here is just to get this idea, it's just, you can actually feel it within yourself, right? Like I one of the first times with Kate, it was really obvious to me, and I knew nothing about Buddhism at the time. And at that time, I knew nothing about auctions. I'd never been to an auction, right? So I had a mate, he went to them, and he used to make his money. He'd go to the auction, he'd buy things cheaply, and sell them, you know, more expensively and make money. I thought, great idea, I'll come along. And then he said, okay, he said, look, what I want you to do is just watch. Don't make a bid on anything. Okay. Could I do that? No way. No way. But come on, that price is so great, I've got to have it. That's a great price. I put my hand up. So I started bidding, you know, and I got these things that after I was going, missed the lesson. I didn't listen to my mate. I couldn't help it. I just thought the deal was so good, I have to put in a bid. And then the trimmer said, yeah, there's a lot of those here, and you would have got it cheaper if you just waited. You know, so I just wanted you to see how the thing works. But I couldn't, and this is what the cherishing does, right? I can't wait to get the good thing, and I can't wait to get rid of the bad thing.
Eddie, in a way, that's what Boxing Day sales and Black Friday sales are, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. They work on that.
They basically latch onto that same thing that drives us, and they take advantage of it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking, like, when I often go shopping, if you look at things, and uninteresting, uninteresting. They put sale, 40% off, and so it's like, ooh, now it's a good deal. So self-cherishing is like, sort of like that, right? It, this energy, just, like, oh, I want. Yeah. It really drives greed, that's for sure, but it also drives fear too, you know, because it cherishes this wrong idea of yourself. So it really tries to protect you, and you really think it's a good thing. You find it's not. it's like thinking you've got a really good mate, and in fact they've been working against you all your life, and you had no idea. Yes, self-cherishing was like. So, like the clinging sides, like the grabbing in, is the call it this desirous attachment, pulling in. But then we have this other side, you know, to like protect. So that means we've got to push away the things that might harm us. So this self-cherishing does both. It pulls stuff in and it pushes stuff away. And it's given different names. You know, one might be called desirous attachment, then another would be called aversion, just because of the activity of the self-cherishing mind. Now, what did I write here? I said, this is it. So the I feels victimized and grows disproportionately large. That's what happens. You'll actually feel it. You actually feel yourself, you're really important at this time, right? I have to do something. This is what it will feel like. So this, what the idea here is, I'll probably get through to you, because as we go through, there are a lot of antidotes to the different problems, and there's lots of different ways of saying what this problem is. But one way you can make it really simple for you yourself is just to say, this is all the fault of self-cherishing. It's like saying all the problems in our country are the problem for the prime minister's rubbish, right? It's really simple, you know, don't go to, this just comes up with the one thing, okay, that's it, that's what I've got to work against. So some of you might be familiar with a text called our 7-point mind training, and in that text it says gather all blame into one, which means that all the objects that you've ever blamed before, instead of putting them all on all those other things, put them on just this one thing, which is the self-cherishing mind, because it's all coming from there. That's the real troublemaker. So like, if you get that, you whack out a whole lot of problems for yourself. And so it says, gather all blame into one. I mean, put all your blames on self-cherishing and nothing out external to yourself. And then it says, and meditate on the great kindness of others. So like when we look at, you know, there's us and there's others. So the others is like out there, right? So you sort of say, okay, so we think our problems are like out there. And he's saying, no, your problems are not out there. They're not, the others are not the source of your deeper source of your problem. The deeper source of our problem is self-cherishing. In fact, the others that you used to blame contribute to your happiness. They're all objects that made you who you are and developed all that stuff, right? He's saying, look upon the external objects as objects of kindness. Look upon all sources of your problems, just like the self-cherishing mind, how you're relating to the external world. And so he's saying, there's nothing really wrong with the external world. The people are fine. Yeah, it's a lovely thing. He said, when the Buddha has looked over the world, he's never ever seen a problematic human being. Humans are not the problem. He says, no, it's mental stuff that you put on humans. So that some of the mental stuff's the self-cherishing. He says, that's the enemy, not them. Think badly of self-cherishing and think well of people. Or the weather, or anything else that's happening. That's the other. So self-cherishing is one thing and everything else is other. All problems, the source of all problems are this, and everything else just contributes to my well-being and stuff. And like he said in the other one, he said, and all blame it to one, meditate on the great kindness of others. So this line, meditate on the great kindness of others. So meditate here means become familiar with how kind others are towards you, and then cultivate their understanding. So this is this word meditation, right? Familiarity and cultivation. Learn to become familiar with the idea that everyone else is being really kind to you, and cultivate that understanding. So, and this really helps you is when you look outwardly, you're not going to see what's the problem, right? You know, no, that's not the problem. The real problem's back here. And it's just a confused mind. It's just the mind that's supporting confusion. And like I see that in the text, you'll see there's a lot of sort of martial analogies and metaphors, meaning sort of warfare, fighting. You know, you've got to fight these things and that. But in fact, you don't. You just see right through them. You know, what knocks them out is your own intelligence. They've all risen from a faulty understanding. So all it requires you to do is see it correctly, and that's it. They're gone. They can't stand up anymore. So this is what we try and do. This is the structure of our misery. Is diagnosed, this is what the Buddha did, which is by recognizing that the self-cherishing attitude compels us to exaggerate the unattractive qualities of a situation, or to over-exaggerate the nice things about the situation. Analysis shows that we instinctively add mental pain to physical or circumstantial difficulties, multiplying the original hardship. This is here. The prescription, what to do, is the cultivation of mindfulness and wisdom to confront this internal process directly. So the mindfulness means you just remember what to do. You remember to either fall for self-cherishing or others are kind. That's what you've got to remember all the time. Otherwise, you just flip back to normal. Others are the problem. And my self-cherishing is my best mate. Right? That's how we've been most of the time. So it's a habit, and it's hard to work against habits, as you all know. Identifying self-cherishing as the true internal enemy empowers us. So I like this because, you know, if you think of it, like if you thought the external enemies were people who are your external enemy, what do you have to do then? They're right. That's right. Thank you. It's as simple as that, isn't it? They're the problem. Get rid of them. Right? And throughout history, people have thought that, haven't they? And done it. Right? But it hasn't actually brought about what they wanted. Right? You just get a new group of people that hate you. You've got to kill them too. It's like, there's them, you know. So it ain't going to work that way. Yeah, so this is the other thing, think of it. If they were that, this is about the only thing you could do, eh? So what can you do to change their mind? Well, you could buy them presents. If people do something, they leave you alone. Pay the bully. Or like you say, Sandy, you've got to fight them. Or you've got to run away, isn't it? But none of these are really ways of empowering ourselves, are they? We're still like being the victim because this thing's got the hold over us. Yeah, so if we can see that actually the problems are coming from here, now we can change that. You see, that isn't it. All you have to do is to change a thought, is to think another thought. It's as simple as that. Or if something is really distracting, just move your eyes away from it. We do this, don't we? We don't like something, just look elsewhere, talk about something else. Go to the movies, go to the fridge. It's as simple as that. Yeah. But here, like I said, the thing is the moving the mind away from one object and placing it on another and coming from that perspective. Is identifying self-cherishing as the true internal enemy empowers us, transforming us from victims to either becoming an author or architect of your own life. So anybody here read Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl? Well, if you have, there's a part in there that he discovered this in the concentration camp. That the only power he really had was the ability to think, was to use his mind. And his oppressors could not take that away from him. And this is the same power we got. And what the thing is, you've got to realize that the one thing that can take it away from you is the self-cherishing. So we still have enemies, it's just that they're not out there. The enemy is your own afflicted mind, mental spaces. So if you know that and agree with it, then you change it on. And like I said, in a way, it's quite straightforward. They say, just change your mind. But sometimes it's not so easy to do, is it? As we all know, right? You might tell us something, then just change your mind, and we go, no, I don't want to. No, it's hard. But that's what's sort of required of us. Yeah, so Frankl found this out, and I found it like it is. It's a tremendously useful knowledge. But to always remember that you yourself are the final arbiter of how things. So this desire and aversion, as you can see, desire goes one way, the aversion goes the other way, and connecting them all is a self-cherishing. And so you've got to go up and down. We've got to keep liking some things and disliking other things. Like we might like, well, I do. I like wealth. I'd like to have a lot of money and count it and look at it and think about it. But dude, I wouldn't like to lose it all. Right? So that's the other side, right? It's like, ooh, you puffed up, feel great. Two problems all right. One is you've got to keep it. And the other is you can lose it. And so both sides are sort of unpleasant, isn't it? Yeah? And that's what they call the suffering of wealth. You think, oh, I've got it all, I'll be great, but you won't be. You'll be concerned about losing it or how to get more or the fact it's dribbling out all the time.
A lot of people trying to take it away.
That's dead right, Terry. People are trying to take it away too, aren't they? Everyone wants to be wealthy and they often look at those who have it, they want to take it. So this is, like I said, so we are sort of swept up and down and even round and round. Because we have things that we really like and want to keep, and there's other things we don't want at all and we don't want them to happen. Now, whether that takes place or not is not entirely up to us. You go, like, why? Because if your mind is under the control of self-grasping and self-cherishing, they're the bosses. They're in charge. So until you decide that no, they're actually problem makers, when you decide that, you start to get back control. And you can take away self-grasping and put in place wisdom. You remove self-cherishing and you put cherishing others. Now you've got a good mind. But until that happens, it's problematic. So in terms of the this is our topic called the eight worldly concerns. So the word worldly has and connotates a number of different meanings. What is it when you hear the word worldly, what does it connotate for you?
Temporal, conventional reality.
Okay, temporal, conventional reality. Yeah, the reality of the ordinary people of the world, isn't it? Well, I first thought of that when I read it. I thought, it's what ordinary people do, you're interested in the world. Jimmy?
Sue says non-spiritual.
Okay, good one. Good one, Sue. Yeah, that's right. This is another way of contrasting, isn't it? Worldly people, spiritual people. The meaning here is a little different than that. word worldly here sort of connotates more sort of uncertain in the fact it's like it's like a like these waves or a one of those things you sit on, seesaws that go up and down, right? It's like worldly means like up and down, no stability. There's these eight concerns that have no stability. What are the things that have no stability? Gain, loss, fame, ignominy, praise, criticism, these things, right? And the word, so some of you have eight worldly concerns, some of it's called eight worldly dharmas. And so here the other word dharma is used really to show like the teaching of the Buddha, but here it's not. It just means a thing that is unstable, the eight things that are unstable, that normal people are really interested in. And those things are like, you know, gain and loss and so forth, as we'll see shortly. So the worldly view is that, you know, external circumstances determine our feelings and the stability of the mind. But when we engage in the Dharma practice, we realize that, that all compounded phenomena, meaning anything that's come together through causes and conditions, is impermanent. So what I like about this is it's quite good is because you look and see, what do you say, all compounded phenomena. You might go, what's a compounded phenomenon? Right? So, you know, and like I said, it's anything to do with causes and conditions. It comes together through causes and conditions. So you might ask, this compounded phenomena, is there something that's not compounded phenomena? Yeah, there is. And then you go, well, what are they? Well, there's only four things, three or four of them. And for most of us, we'll never come across them in their life. Right? So nearly everything for us will be compounded phenomena, which makes it easy, isn't it? You don't need to go on the uncompounded. You go, well, I'll tell you what the uncompounded are, right? Simply, the emptiness is an uncompounded phenomenon. Selflessness is an uncompounded phenomenon. And emptiness and selflessness, just different words, so basically the same thing. The other one they use is, and emptiness is a true cessation. Nirvana is a true cessation. So true cessations, for instance, nirvana, are absences, and they're never going to be filled. And that absence is permanent. So there's only three or four things in the world. So most of us, we don't need to worry about it. But like you used to go, pain and gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and ignominy, these eight worldly concerns, are they products? Are they compounded? You have to. They are. So you can discover this. Just ask, well, what is necessary to be famous? This is a question for us. What's the question? What's required to be famous?
Talent.
Talent.
Right time, right place.
Talent, time, place.
I said not necessarily talent.
Not necessarily talent. Yep.
Sue says fans.
Fans, that's right. You need fans, you've got to be famous. You're going to have to some sort of media. So these are causes or conditions. So these are, so they take to anything. What? Well, how about infinite? And yes, I need people to say I'm a bad man. I've actually got to have done something or not, so others think that I am a bad man. It's got to be known. So these are all things. So you go, ah, it's all compounded then. They are compounded. So you think of anything, it depends upon all these little parts. You pull a part out, or weaken one part, the whole thing starts to...
House of cards.
Yeah, that's right. It's dead rock, Terry. It's a house of cards is a good analogy here. You know, it's made up of all these unstable things. And this is what we're about, the worldly concerns about. This fame is unstable. Gain and loss, they're unstable. You can lose gain, but loss, you don't have to keep losing. You can go back up again. You know, so it's all up and down.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's called uncompounded space. You have to say sort of uncompounded space too. This is a compounded space as well. Yeah, so it's uncompounded space, The true cessations of like nirvana or Buddhahood. And there's another type of cessation that is also present. So these are the little three. Two types of cessation and uncompounded space. Yeah, so often we present these courses and people go like, so what's uncompounded? And we all get stuck there. It's really hard to understand. Let's go to the stuff that's easy first. And on all these four pairs, they're sort of easy. We understand them. We just got to get introduced to them. And you got to know that like, it goes up and down. That's what it's all saying. So gee, you don't want to put all your trust in it. In fact, a little while ago, I saw something on YouTube. I said, they're asking all these young girls what they wanted to be when they grew up. And the girls about 12, 13, so many of them said, famous. I want to be famous. Yeah, I get it. But you don't know. You just see the upside of it and not the downside. Yeah. And that's what this sort of program is about. It's like, don't get hooked on the upside, but there's a downside. Right? Yeah, like after you get hooked, you get eaten. Yeah. So basically, it's sort of saying here, so as you'll see later on, the idea from all of this is just for you to walk away and go, yeah, underneath all these worldly concerns is these two things, self-grasping, self-cherishing. It's all coming from there. So I can either work against any of these eight worldly concerns on an individual, or I can come back and look at the root cause and go self-cherishing, self-grasping. I can work on it there too. So you've got different aspects of work you can do. Yeah, so this is a quote from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, where he says, all the harm with which this world is rife, all fear and suffering that there is, clinging to the I has caused it. What am I to do with this great demon? This is like this way of sort of summarizing everything up. And often when you do this, you come across a verse like this, or the complementary verse, where he says, all the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself. Some of this can really rock you. You read that stuff and go, geez, and think about your life and how what you've been trying to do all for yourself and what the outcomes are. It's sort of shocking, I found at least. And, and it's also shocking to go, geez, I don't have to do the opposite. And, gosh, that looks difficult. It's so much easier just working for me. Put it that way, even though it doesn't work. So, is there anything you guys would like to add to this or say about this? So, I'm just sort of introducing you to the material, right? So, this is not like a deep dive into it or anything like that. Just get an overall view of it. There's probably quite a number of different answers you can give here, and it would be highly dependent on the spiritual maturity of the person who's going through the difficulty. So I'd say, look, if you don't know anything about Buddhism and the Dharma and sort of thing, you can only work on the way you are right now, right? And from my perspective, you can look at it and go, well, yes, there's grasping at the eye, there's self-cherishing, all this sort of stuff. But it's also true, like you say, when you're in danger, you have to save yourself. You have to save your life. You might ask yourself, is that self-cherishing? The answer would be no. Is there self-grasping going on? Yeah. But even when we die, we have virtue grabbed by self-grasping. There's little we can do about that until we remove self-grasping. It's not a wrong thing to do at all. You have to protect yourself like that. Again, there is a self that does exist, and it's worthy of protection. It's worthy of being saved. And self-grasping will help to do that because it'll go grook, and then the self-cherishing will go, I'll help too. This how it is. Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, it's like really quick. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
You're not speaking philosophical.
No.
I think when I think about that situation, I have read some stories where people have developed themselves so much, but because they didn't react the way that the other person kind of expected them to react, which is being scared or confronting them or defensive, it actually diffused the situation because the other person just got thrown off kilter and went, oh, I wasn't expecting you to connect to my humanity.
That's right, I've heard that with the stories too. Yes, it entirely depends upon the person who's going through the difficulty, I guess. Yeah, I think that's how I'd approach it. You have to approach this on an individual level and go, the advice I give you is not suitable for Sandy or for Terry. For them, it might be a different type of advice. Another way of showing you how this desirous attachment works and the self-cherishing works. Suppose you have some really nice crockery, or even like a nice car, right? And you have some guests over, and maybe one or two people like gets a bit rowdy, and the cutlery is broken. Right? If you feel pain or any sort of like disturbance about that, where is that coming from? Is that coming from the broken cup, or is that coming from something about us? So if we look here, then you can lessen your suffering immediately. You can also know, okay, it's not the cup, it's my mind that's creating my suffering. It's not the fact that the cup is broken. A lot of people sitting here don't give a damn about it. But somehow or other, I do. So you'll see the same as like with your car, right? If you walk out and you see somebody going along with a screwdriver, just go, same thing's going to happen, isn't it? Because like that's mine. And mine is mine, and you are hurting mine. And so you're going to do something. These are examples of, I think, this is the sort of stuff that happens in our world, isn't it? But you can go like, so again, if you see the person, or even if sometimes in the car park, and people open the door and they bang into the car next door, people get upset with that, don't they? Yeah, that's right. What you want to do is like be thinking about it before it happens, right? Like in here or when you're at home, thinking, Jesus, it's not the cups, it's not the door, it's not anything out there that's the problem. That's not what hurts me. It's this mind. It's the mind of self-cherishing. That's what's hurting me. Yeah. So it's sort of like, and try and do that like a lot of times. So you switch from gradually going, this is the problem. This is causing my pain. To finding that self-cherishing is the pain driver here. You'll need to do this a lot, because the habit has been to look outwards and look for where the harm is coming. So this is one way you've got to create a new habit, a new way of looking at it.
Something Venerable Thupten Children said that I found really interesting, because when you possess something, it's really hard to convince yourself that actually it's all from your side, the projection. And she said, well, think about before you buy an object, if someone damages it, you don't care. But the moment you bought it and someone damages it, suddenly it's a big deal. And I was like, it's so subtle, but like, where did suddenly the anger come from, right? It's the same object. But then the moment you possess it, it's like suddenly I am hurt. So, I don't understand that.
Right. Yeah, well, Hollis used to talk about that when he was, when he used to buy a watch. He'd be standing out looking at the window, and no aversion, no attachment to the watches. They're just nice looking watches. Right? If you were to walk in and the shop owner was to drop the watch on the floor and break it, you might feel a little bit of concern for him there. But if you had bought it yourself and then dropped it on the floor, your response will be very different, won't it? And this is the sort of thing where you can tell, this is the self-cherishing. And often, one of the instructions that you try and tell yourself, not mine, not mine, not mine. Yeah. And that you say that sort of things, you sort of you analyze to go, where is the real me that owns the real watch? And of course, the real me and the real watch aren't found under analysis. So it's true, it's not yours. Yeah, and you think, yeah, okay, that's helpful. So this is our first meditation. Just sit comfortably. So we're going to investigate truth. We want to discover whether we have real enemies external to ourselves who are causing us problems. So we have to decide, is our enemy an external person or a situation, or is it our self-cherishing mind? What's the self-cherishing mind? It's this inner habit that we have that clings to praise and fears blame. It clings to pleasure and fears pain. Self-cherishing always sees our own welfare as most important. So what's the function of self-cherishing? Well, from its point of view, it might say it's to help us. But our experience is that it constantly disturbs a peaceful mind. It makes us a victim of life's ups and downs. The mind of self-cherishing is seen as a great thief and a robber. It's called a murderer. It's denigrated many, many times in the Buddhist texts. But it basically steals our happiness. It destroys our happiness. It makes the mind unpeaceful. But why is this inner thief so hard to spot? This self-cherishing, the inner thief, is really hard to spot because it disguises itself as our protector, as our friend. It's convincing us that external things are the real threat to the peace that we're seeking. So how might we be able to notice this thief in action during the normal course of our day? So you will notice the presence of the thief, self-cherishing, during the day. The moment your mind becomes dependent on something outside of you. The moment your peaceful state of mind becomes dependent upon something outside of you. Understanding this, how might we be able to apply this when we ourselves feel upset? We just gently turn our attention inward. We turn our attention away from the external triggers and acknowledge this inner thief of self-cherishing. See, this is the actual true source of disturbance. And that identification is an empowering awareness. So know that just by identifying this inner thief, we can reclaim our own power. And therefore, the source of our own peace is always within our own hands. Now, breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth. So now we come to the identification of these eight worldly concerns, and this is taken from a Pali text, which is gain and loss, disrepute and fame, blame and praise, pleasure and pain. These eight worldly concerns revolve around the world, and the world revolves around the eight worldly concerns. So according to the Buddha, everything we do in this world is shaped by these dharmas. And dharma is just like a factor, right? Factors that function as the eight worldly concerns. Constantly preoccupied with them, ordinary people chase short-term happiness and are blocked from developing deeper, more stable states of mind. And these states appear as four pairs of opposing factors. Now, I don't know if this is sort of, it's not common knowledge, but these are eight worldly concerns and the attachment and aversion we have to each side, they are, let's say, the attachment and aversion have degrees of heaviness, you might say. And so these different degrees are given colors. So they say there's the eight world, there's the black eight worldly concerns, the eight worldly concerns that are mixed, and there are the eight worldly concerns that are white. But they are all problematic, whether they're white, black, or mixed. Right? That stays the same. It's just like, how bad are they when they're black? How bad are they when they're white? And how bad when they're mixed? So when they talk about being black, it's just this unbridled motivation of attachment to the immediate happiness. So just like when I saw that when the things were being auctioned, that obviously that would be black immediately. That was attachment for sure. You know, had to have those looters thinking they're going to make me happy. If I had them, I could make money. I'm happy. That's a black one, right? The white ones are, you don't have that part, but you do have the grasping at them as being real. They objectively exist. Right? So this, in other words, yes, they are louvers, but we identify them as truly existent louvers in the case of wanting to buy the louvers. If you had attachment to a person, it would be, this is your person, that's true, that's correct, but you've overestimated them over their existence. So that would be like the white. It's not so much the major problem is just this self-grasping. And self-grasping nearly always kicks off self-cherishing. They go together in ordinary people. And when they're mixed, there's not that much concern for like an example of like me buying something, like the attachment to, I'll give you a better example, I think. A different example would be, in the Buddha Dharma, you've got two types of practitioners in general. So one group is trying to get rid of self-grasping, and the other group is trying to get rid of self-grasping and self-cherishing. So one group, you get rid of the self-grasping, but the self-cherishing is there. The other group has to get rid of the self-grasping and the self-cherishing, in other words. So who might, what's an example of someone who's got rid of the self-grasping, but not the self-cherishing? then you, from a Mahayana perspective, you say all those people who just wanted self-liberation, all those people that just wanted to look after themselves, free themselves from suffering, that's a good thing. So you get rid of self-grasping, but there's still that subtle self-cherishing. This is all done for yourself. You know? It's still like, this is an authentic way in the Dharma. It's okay. It's just like, if you can't get your head around, like, gee, self-cherishing? Yeah, you know, they down. They go, self-cherishing, that's too hard. To bring all beings to a lot of it, you must be joking. That's too hard, man. Like, it's hard enough for me. So you go, okay, yeah, so those people, that's where you get this mixed one. Right? They got rid of the self grasping, but there's still the self-cherishing there. Like, so that goes up all the way, sort of thing. Just to let you know, you have like these like degrees in each of these factors. And here we have our four pairs. So there's different ways of talking about it. One is called attachment, or a version of this called attachment, just an overestimating. So on the good side, let's call that delight, and on the other side, it's not. So here we are. Now, receiving money or possessions, we really like that, but we overestimate how good it is. On the other side, not receiving or losing money or possessions. And as you can see, so we just go through them like this. With pleasurable sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tangible objects, all the objects of the senses, we can overestimate them in relationship to our feelings. So this second level is really about feelings. You know, and with those objects that cause produce an unpleasant feeling, we don't want the object and we don't want the feeling. So we're averse to it. And we think it's really like bad. Yeah, we overestimate the bad. In terms of our reputation, most of us, well, like I said, the girls want to be famous, right? No one wants to be, not like, you don't exist, you don't matter, you want the other side. And of course, the other side's like, yeah, no one wants to be thought badly of either, to go through the world, you know, people pointing at them, this is the fellow who did this or that. Don't like it. Of course, on the other side, again, in terms of praise and approval or criticism, we all want the praise and the approval. We don't want to be criticized, so forth. So it's interesting, just talking about this now, saying it, because I watched a documentary last night on Elon Musk. Anybody know about his childhood? He had a terrible childhood. And what, from one perspective, right, from the perspective of the world, because he was criticized heavily. He was beaten up often. He was like the abject outsider. But it made him to be the few. He had to realize it was all on him. So that's what he spent all his time as a kid, studying, studying, studying. I want to know how the world works. That's what he's really interested in. Like, how do I work? How does it work? How does this thing work? Years and years just reading, you know, books. Of course, like, he's the nerd, just like now, right? You get beaten up. That's what happened to him. And it's in South Africa, right? A really violent place. And that's what he's saying. It was interesting watching his face. You just see the pain come across, you know? It was interesting to watch, because he's not a person that has a great deal of control over his emotions. So you can see him across his face, you know, like the hurts that come out. Because, you know, the interviewers are trying to, you know what they do, right? Trying to get you. Well, they get him. Like, they say the words, man. It's like, nevertheless, he had to, like, it was because he was criticized for having, because he was blamed, because he was never seen as far as, like, you'd be nothing. But one of the interviews in the Sydney, you notice about Elon, is like, and there's a number of other blokes I've been watching, like, these famous people I've been watching, like, what makes them the great people, right? And one of the things is to take criticism, to take blame, and think nothing of it. They don't get upset. It's just like, move on, next thing. Problems, they don't see them as problems. In fact, one of the stories I remember about it was, you know, he hires a lot of people, and this bloke comes to them with a problem they've got, and he fires them immediately. You know why? Because their job's to solve problems, not to bring them to him. You don't know your place here, mate. Find another job. And yeah, so he's been married a few times. He's an unusual fellow, that's for sure. He's not got a mind like ours. And like his wives are saying to him, yeah, you get about 2 hours of his life every day. That's about it. If you can't put up with it, you'll get divorced. Of course, he gets divorced, because people can't put up with it. But you know, just looking at this one, Jesus, he's gone the other side. You know what we don't like? He's trained himself to put up with and to actually accept. You know, and so I thought, wow, that's like this, you know. This is what we're to do. So don't look at one of the things. Sorry, I'm getting carried away here. This is it. I'll read this. We must be careful in terms of how we understand these sets of practice. We should not think the 8 worldly dharmas means that we should not have them, or that we should go out of our way not to gain anything. And we should not think that being praised is better than being denigrated and so forth. But it means that we should not look for them too much. So this was shocking for me to read. This is only recent. I've been doing this for like about 20 years, you know? And I've got and everything I've read about, it's like they're really, really bad, and like you've got to get rid of them, and there's no way to engage in a spiritual path when you do. And you really go, well, I'm a bloke just starting. What? Like, where do I get anywhere if I can't get rid of these? And then to see His Holiness says, not look for them too much. Now that I can do. You know, all of us can do that. We can look, you know, we can run it through and go, yeah, you know, you might think, oh, cancer's a terrible thing, but you know, what's the good thing about it? You know, so it might change the way of living your life. You know, people often say this, don't they? Like, it changed my life. You go, yeah, that's right. So it's not exactly all bad, is it? Right? And that's what he's sort of saying here. Don't focus but too much on either the bad side or the good side. Don't cling too much.
So it's almost like we don't rely on the 8 worldly concerns. They will come in our lives and they will go in our lives. Yeah. And we expect them and we deal with them as best we can when that happens. But we don't go out of our way chasing them or pushing them away.
Yeah, and also, you know, like, so it's one of the things he says, we should not care too much whether people are praising us or putting us down. You know, so we all know when it's too much is when we've got them by the neck. It's too much, right? We're too much. So we should not care too much whether people are praising us or putting us down, or that one wants any kind of pain. It also means that we should be able to handle losses when they occur and not be thrown into a deep state of depression or despair. Yeah, it's just sort of finding a little way with us, and, you know, looking at it and going, you know, sometimes we are praised, there are times when we are blamed. This is true. Sometimes we're richer, sometimes we're poorer. But it's just so that don't get too upset about this, right? I think that's the real thing to take away from this and not become too extreme and go, you know. Again, another thing I should point out, money in the possessions is not the problem. And having no money and no possessions is not the problem. Never being praised is not such a great thing. And always being praised is, it's all over. So what's the problem here? If it's not in the pleasurable sights. As I said, look, there's no problem with looking at things and appreciating them or tasting lovely food, all these things. That's not the problem. Having fame, that's not a problem. Being unknown, that's not a problem. What's the problem then? Yeah, okay, and so what's driving the actions? Yeah, that's it. This desirous attachment or the aversion? Yeah, it's the aversion, it's the mental things. The aversion or the desirous attachment. That's the problem. Not food, not fame, Not money, not any of those things. They're not the problem. So he said, don't have too much attachment to money or to fame, big focus. Yeah, you'll enjoy it, no problem. Yeah, but also, as you said, I said, well, they do it here on Black Friday. That's right. It's like stimulus and spend our income and feel really good about what we buy. Yeah, so marketeers and these two wings of business, market and they're really geniuses at using phenomena to influence the mind.
Advertising.
Ad, thank you, advertising, yeah. Marketing and advertising, they know heaps about, I mean, that's where most money is spent around learning how we work, right? And they use it to their advantage. So we can sort of understand what they're doing to us. We go, hang on a minute, no, I don't need to buy into it. So basically, let's have a look at this. I'm looking at that. Wow. So gain and loss, I'll put this picture up here. You know, when you get those, you must have seen the pictures or you have the experience yourself. The idea is like, say, you've got all the sand, right? But you're on the beach and you build up this wonderful home and you're so pleased with it. And then a wave comes and whoosh, gone. And most times kids get really upset, don't they? You know, and the parent has to come along and go, well, dad's not upset, mum's not upset. So that's the clue, right? Why? They don't have attachment to the sandcastle, you do. So yeah, building sandcastles is fine. No need to cry though when the water comes in. So what this tells us, so this water is like change, meaning impermanence. None of the stuff is stable. That's what it's all saying. And because it's not, don't cling to it as if it were. Because that would be a wrong response, wouldn't it? If you know it's not stable and impermanent, it's subject to change. You don't want to hold on to it as if it's not going to change. Get yourself in trouble. So this is what this is about. So now, pleasure and pain. So I put these bubbles up and the sand castles because they're different analogies to show you how you can deal with the attachment and the aversion. So physical feelings, they're described, and the analogy given is that they are like bubbles for feelings. And so it's not like bubbles like this, you know, the pictures like this. It's bubbles. So you might have, if you've ever seen the surface of a lake or water and the rain hits it and the bubbles form, like it's the force of the water coming down from the sky hits us and you get a bubble and it's gone. That's how our feelings are. They're like that. But the problem for us is we cling to the feeling. And you find yourself in many conversations you can have where either yourself or another person's had a feeling a while ago, but they're talking about it now as if it's the same feeling. But it's definitely not. So it's like, you know, like, well, and this is where they say the big problem is permanence. Freezing impermanent phenomena into permanent things, taking something that happened a long time ago, putting it in the present, talking about it as real now. The terrible thing about it is you're going to get the response of it. You're going to get the experience of it right now as if it were the real thing. In fact, the thing happened ages ago, or yesterday, or 10 minutes ago. And I say, you're not dealing with real feelings here. They're gone. They go, like I said, that's what I give the knowledge of the gone. They're going like that. But it's happening so fast for us, we don't even recognize it. And this is why, you know, why meditation is so important, especially on mindfulness of feelings. You actually just sit there and create a feeling and generate one and see what actually happens. Now, what is the feeling? So actually try and have an experience of one rather than just, you know, the knowledge of it. Because the problem with knowledge of it is we reify it each time. So then it becomes like, it's going to always appear to us, it's the same thing. It's not. So this, you know, these extreme reactions towards our feelings, they don't help us. reputation, fame, and esteem. So, as you said, chasing a good reputation is like trying to paint a self-portrait on the surface of a rushing river. No rushing river there, but to get a general idea, you exhaust yourself trying to hold the image in place, but the current of changing circumstances washes it away the moment you lift your brush. This is the other, this is one of the things we're saying. Anybody read that poem, Ozymandias? If you ever read that, that is a great thing to show this. And it's called Ozymandias. And what it happens is it talks about a wanderer in the desert, and he comes across these ruins, and in the ruins is this huge statue of a head. And it says, I am the great Ozymandias, creator of the world. And you look there, and there's nothing but sand for miles and miles and miles of crushed rock, and just that head of rock in the name. Like that, so I just go, man, that's all over the world. You go to any country and just look back, and all the cities are gone. All the people are gone. All the people who are famous, it's not there. If there was anyone famous, it exists only as a memory now. And what use is that to anyone? Where is this history of some country in South America? So you know those big the tombs you can... You see those aerial views of Mexico on the tombs? That are built, you go, wow, it's like city of pyramids. You know what were on them? Pictures of the guys who created them. It was like the modern, it's like what we do for advertising now. That was their advertising. They were, I'm the greatest. Look at me. So all those big things were all colored and painted into the picture of the guy who did it, the ruler. You know, it's like we don't even know who they are anymore. And then social standing, praise and blame. This is the pair of praise and blame, or approval and criticism, or approval and disapproval, is intimately related to social standing because they represent the core mental factors through which ordinary beings constantly seek validation and confirmation of their perceived wealth and image within society. Praise is the desire for approval and accolades, elevating our perceived standing, while blame is the rejection or criticism or derogatory words which threatens to demolish the image. Realize that words of praise and blame are transient, external phenomena. So in the, it's interesting, you know, that's still like words, those things that bricks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Your words can't hurt you physically. Yeah, look how we behave towards the way. Like, if you sort of hit me with a stick, you go, right. And we want to do the same when they use their words, don't we? It's like I'll do the same to you. But actually, you look, in one of the Dharma books I read about words, so I was thinking like the written word, you know, but they were talking about the words spoken. And they said, so what is a word spoken? Now, when you break it up, it's go, well, you've got, there must be some, what is it? It's sounds. You might call them vowels, I guess, eh? There's that sort of thing. So you could say, is it the whole word that hurts you? Is it just the syllable? Is it the sound? You know, and you go, none of it, none of it, none of it. So why are you hurt? How come you hurt? And is it, well, because I cling to what I could perceive the meaning of it to be. So we grab the meanings of these words, no? And put them on us. You need that and go to this trap, right? So like I said, this is what really creates the big problems. We know we've got aversion and attachment to the mind. It just does it sort of automatically. But when it comes up, we want one or the other. It's, you know, that's just, and when we get one side that we don't like, we're going to react against it, get upset. If we get what we do like, we're happy chappies. It's cool. Like I said, if this is what I take to be my major way of working with this stuff, and it is this, look, that's it. That's it. Like I said, I take this because from a question, like you ask this question, where is the problem? Like if you look for a problem in the world, I'll tell you now, you'll never find one. There's nothing out there like problem written over anything. This is it. Here we go. We found it. Yeah, no. It comes from this side. We have to, we label it problem, and now we're averse. Or we're very interested if we want to solve it. So I found this idea really useful. The aversion and the attachment are sort of coming up from us. The aversion is about we're overemphasizing the negative aspect of it. Attachment is we're overestimating the positive aspect of it. So in other words, we're sort of not seeing the object clearly. So with this, the misconception is we instinctively believe that external circumstances, such as misfortune, criticism, or loss, are the sources of our difficulty and suffering. This is a natural, quick thing to happen. Nearly everyone will think this. Right? Our job is to, yes, we think about it and disagree with it. Yeah, it looks like that, but it's not. The true cause is the internal reactivity driven by self-cherishing. So self-cherishing is driving this attachment and aversion from the mind side. The true cause is the internal reactivity driven by self-cherishing, causing us to pursue those desirable worldly objects and to reject the undesirable. The implications are, since the suffering exists inside our mind, we can control and transform it. That's the beauty of it. If we're out there, it's like trying to get your kids to do what you want them to. Good luck. It's hard, eh? It's much easier than we just decide what we want to do. It's easy. And that's the place to work. So the primary solution of all is the cultivation of equanimity and applying the antidote of wisdom, realizing the interests of inherent existence. So in the next few weeks, I'm going to take you through the different antidotes you can use. The simplest of them is impermanence. None of these phenomena are stable. You can go from impermanence, then work against the self-cherishing by doing giving and taking or equalizing exchanging. That will lead you right up into equanimity, and from equanimity you can go to emptiness. But there's lots of solutions here. It's just you have to apply them. You have to remember, it's not out there, it's back here, and this is the antidote. This is what I need to remind myself of. The lovely thing about this is, as His Holiness says, if we stop blaming the others, then we undermine the basis for all future suffering. Remember, I said these two things we need to do. We need to stop blaming others, and the other thing is think of their kindness. They're very good antidotes to our suffering. Like I said, most of us, like I said, our natural go is we look outside. Who's that French philosopher whose definition of hell said other people? I go, yeah, mate, you're wrong. But it's a nice saying, isn't it? My definition of hell is other people, just being around them drives us nuts. Sorry? No. There's a French guy who said this. Yeah. Anyway, but he said, I love this, I said, yeah, if we stop living and go put the blame on self-cherishing, that's actually the problem maker, not the people. And it makes their lives a big problem too. There's not much difference between ourselves. Yeah, the difference is I know it and they don't. So of course they're going to keep blaming me because they don't know. But from my side, I have to stop blaming them, isn't it? So that's not true.
And if you wake up every morning going, hell, it's other people, you have to basically wake up ready to fight every day because you're going to encounter people all day long.
That's right. That's right. It makes life terrible, doesn't it?
And you've got no power.
No, not at all. No, that's right. There's terrible things that follow from saying that, isn't there? Yeah. Okay, last meditation, then we'll call it a day. Okay, let's get settled. We want to investigate whether the truth about peace that we're looking for comes from our own attitudes, not from external circumstances. So the issue is not experiencing gain or loss, but the mind's habit of grasping one and pushing away the other. Because this pattern makes our happiness dependent on unpredictable external events. Now, imagine if you're a sailor on a small sailing boat. You cannot control the wind, but you can adjust the sails of the boat. In the same way, we can't control the events that life will throw at us, but we can adjust our attitude towards them. So why is adjusting our inner sails more effective than commanding the wind? Well, this is because the winds of life are uncontrollable, while the sails of attitude are always within your own power to adjust. So how can you tell if you're fighting the wind or adjusting the sails in a difficult moment? So fighting the wind feels like a struggle. Adjusting the sails feels like a sort of flexible and balanced response. So for the rest of the day, just rest in the knowledge that you are the sailor. You're capable of navigating in any weather. So either hoist the sails or bring them down. It's up to you. And breathing in, exhaling, letting go. So today, you know that there are these four pairs of worldly concern. Like there's gain and loss, pain and pleasure, fame and infamy, praise and blame. There is a, you might be able to find these books upstairs. Teachings from Tibet, we've got a number of those up there, and there's this commentary on 8 verses of thought transmission. They're for free, but you can make a donation for them. And there may be even some of these how to practice Dharma books. Like I said, this, if you have it, you're right, of course, try and read these pages. If not, there may be some free ones still upstairs that you can find. It's a terrific book, this book, How to Practice Dharma. And so next week we're going to look at four of these concerns, gain and loss, which relate to our external security, and pleasure and pain, which relate to our physical feelings. What antidotes can we use and how can we use them when we have aversion or attachment to either of these?
Okay.
So I'll see you then. So let's dedicate our merit then. So due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha, lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. Then may the supreme jewel, body teacher, not yet born and last in birth, where that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as human beings remain, may I too remain to describe the sorrows of the world. A prayer for the long life of His Holiness. The wish granting, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, a prayer for the authentic identification of the new rebirth and his quick return to us. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable Venerable Guru, to you I make this request. Okay, thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for the people online, and have a good day. God bless.